Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 280 of Registry Matters. Good evening, happy Saturday, how are you?
Doing awesome, how are you?
I'm very, well, you sound super enthused, Larry, are you okay? Did you get enough Geritol?
No, they don't make anything for anyone my age.
They haven't experienced anything. I think the oldest person known is like 120-something. God, I heard this on the on a program the other day. Of the oldest recorded person, like verified, was around 120, but generally it's about 114, and that's about it.
Well, what about
what have you done?
What about Methuselah, who lived to be 969?
Okay, I don't want to go into that conversation. Because I'll end up upsetting people. So I'll stop. But if you're new to the show, make sure that you subscribe on YouTube and you can press the notification bell and make sure that you subscribe using your favorite podcast app. And then you can download the show and you can get it just in your podcast feed. And it's just an amazing way to do it. So do me a favor, Larry, and tell me what we have going on this evening.
Well, we have a case from the New Mexico Supreme Court was resolved in our favor. It's State versus Marquez or Marquez. We have some listener comments and questions, and we have a bill that was signed by Governor Newsom in California, and I don't like it. And it's likely to make its way across the United States. And we have, what else do we have? I think you dropped something in. Plus, I have an article from The Nation from that lefty magazine.
Yeah, there's that. And then somebody posted something on the Discord server earlier about Bubba the Love Sponge and his people are going out doing some things that are just not cool.
So, well, all right. Well, let's go.
All right. So to begin things off, oh, God, I had the wrong screen pulled up. All right. So this is a two-part question from Doug in Michigan. And I know from reading the RM transcripts that my parole stipulations are supposed to be tailored for moi, correct? Well, I had to sign a document called the MDOC, Internet Usage Agreement, that would be the Michigan Department of Corrections Internet User Agreement, in order to be able to get online. One stipulation is I cannot utilize social media. When they read that off, I was thinking, no Facebook, meh, no big deal. But once home and actually on the internet, I began to realize how many websites are now considered social media websites, such as Discord and Patreon. Yeah, those probably would be considered it. I also began to think about how this user agreement is most likely a blanket document and not tailored to me. The only part of my crime that might be considered social media is the fact Craigslist was utilized, but not for the crime itself. See below. I am considered a low-risk offender, and my crime was not motivated for sexual gratification or the interest of minors. Can/should I challenge the stipulation? And how would I? Will this piss off my parole agent, who already has my email password and is probably reading this right now?
Now, can you at least admit that that's funny, that he's writing it knowing that it's being subject to being monitored in real time?
To tell you the truth, though, so not funny, Larry, none of this is ever funny, but I know that you're required to give up your usernames, but I didn't know that anybody was required to give up the passwords to things.
I've heard of it before, absolutely, while you're under supervision particularly, but I've heard of it beyond supervision. I forgot what state, but I've heard of it. But based on what he conveyed to us regarding his case, which was very detailed, they're probably on fairly solid grounds for this particular condition, but it would be interesting to find out if this is a blanket condition applied to every PFR under supervision in that particular district. Nevertheless, even if it is not narrowly tailored to him, I would not encourage such a challenge. It would not end up going well for him. Do you happen to remember a case in Georgia where the person told the PO to take their polygraph machine and shove it? Do you remember how that ended?
It did not end well. I do recall that.
Yes, so it's not going to go well for him if he does that. But it would be if he could do some slick investigating to figure out if this is just a blanket condition that they're handing to everyone. There might be something to challenge, but I would not suggest he be the one based on what I saw in the narrative that he provided, which would take a long time to read. But he did provide us a lot of detail about what went on underneath his conviction. So yes, I would not encourage it.
But if it's a blanket provision, describe why that would be plausible if it were a blanket restriction. Forget his specifics.
Well, if it were a blanket condition they're applying to everyone, restricting their access to the internet and particularly social media, we would fall back on the case out of North Carolina and Packingham, and we would say that this is a blanket and arbitrary condition that has nothing to do with public safety. If your crime had nothing to do with the internet, but his did.
Okay. All right, then. Well, then here's the part two part. He goes, do I have any standing to challenge how the registry is being applied to me? In 2015, I ended up pleading guilty to production of CP. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea what was going on during the court process. My lawyer whispered in my ear to say, in fact, I served nearly 4 years before discovering that I pled guilty to production. Without going down that rabbit hole, I petitioned the judge and was assigned state attorneys to file an appeal and redo everything. But then, you know, that bad thing, that COVID thing hit, and getting out on parole became the quickest route to freedom. Anyway, I produced those videos in 2010, but my attorney allowed the state of my arrest, which was in June 30th of 2015, to stand as the date of offense. This is a problem because the law was different in 2010, as production of CP only applied if it was for distribution, not personal use, as was the case for me. The law changed in 2011 or 2012 after someone fought their case all the way to the state Supreme Court, who ruled, as the law was written, production cannot be applied to cases of personal use. In 2011 or 12, the legislature rewrote the law. I should have been charged with possession, which has a 4-year max instead of production, and a sentence of 8 to 20 years.
So, yeah, there was one little misspeak there when you were reading that, but that is not significant. It was the date of his arrest, not the state. The date of his arrest was 2015, and that was the date that was established as the date of the offense. But he's saying that the offense occurred in 2010. But what I would, I can see his point. Both his actual sentence and his registration obligation could be different had the date of his offense been recorded correctly rather than 2015. If that is in fact the case, this would be an example of an order nunc pro tunc.
Nunc pro tunc?
Nunc
what is
pro
that?
Tunc. Well, we've mentioned it from time to time. You've heard it, and so has the audience. It's a way for a court to correct mistakes. And it's a Latin term, and it means the court is issuing an order now for then. So it would overlay the order that they issued. If the date of the offense was actually 2010, when you were setting up the factual basis for the plea, the prosecution sure has to establish a factual basis. We can't just let a person plead guilty without any factual basis to underline that plea of guilty. So we have to underpin the plea with a factual basis. So the prosecutor, when they articulated the factual basis, if they said 2015 and it was actually 2010, you would want to change that if there are significant problems that they're created by that misstatement of the factual basis. So you would issue a new order now, nunc pro tunc, that would correct that mistake. So that's what it is. It's just a Latin term that means now for then.
And so then what do you think he should do?
Well, he needs an attorney. And that attorney needs to know the prosecutor's office in that jurisdiction very well and have a good relationship with him. This is one of those cases where you do not need to bring in some big dollar lawyer from the outside that comes in like a battering ram. You need somebody who's a part of the system there who can go in and have a conversation. And that conversation needs to be cordial. And He also needs to be in good standing with his PO, which is the reason why he wouldn't want to do what he raised in question one. And his treatment provider needs to say glowing things about him. And you might could get a prosecutor to agree to sign off on a nunk-pro-tunk. If the prosecutor will not agree to sign off, if that doesn't mean you can't get a nunk-pro-tunk, it just means it's going to be a lot more work because he's going to have to file a motion and have a hearing, and he's got to go through a whole bunch of red tape trying to achieve what his goal is. Now, remember, folks, we've done no research on this. This is all just based on what he's told us. So we can't tell him what to do other than he needs to get a competent attorney in Michigan, particularly in that jurisdiction, and he needs to try to see if he can undo this. But based on what he said, he might have a shot at getting a new order.
So you're saying he should get an attorney that is part of colloquially known as the good old boy system?
That would be my thought process, because the attorney needs to be able to have a real conversation with these people about how important this is, and they have to trust him. They're generally not going to trust somebody that comes in from out of state that they've had no dealings with in the past. They don't know how this is going to bite them in the, you know what? They're already thinking about how can this bite me, and they don't need a showboat coming in that's going to make them look bad. So you really need a person who's a member of the club to go in strategically for this.
I see. And does this make a bunch of publicity at all if someone does this?
Not necessarily, but it could.
Okay. I'm thinking it's just some sort of administrative thing, and someone goes into the computer and like backspace, change date, enter, poof, new things are applied.
Well, no, it's going to be a judicial order. It's going to be filed. So it's going to be a brand new, that it'll be titled Nunc Pro Tunc.
Okay.
So it'll have the case number, it'll have the judge's signature, the prosecutor's signature, the defense attorney's signature, and it'll be a new public document. So it won't be anything that's hidden. So therefore, the prosecution is going to be thinking about how can this blow up on me?
I think that's what they're always thinking, isn't it?
That's their job. They're elected. What do you want them to think?
Well, I mean, I was having a conversation with some friends last night and saying that we got on the subject roughly on the margins of criminal justice stuff. And I was just trying to tell them that prosecutors, it's just a different kind of currency. They're in the business of getting prosecutions. They're not necessarily interested in justice. And they want to be reelected, most likely. And if something blows up in their face, that would be a way to not be reelected. But it's not necessarily about them getting a paycheck. Most of us are incentivized by getting a paycheck and not being fired.
I still want to believe in my idealistic world that not all prosecutors are that way, and not even the majority of prosecutors are that way. I want to believe that prosecutors are they're seeking justice, and that they're going forward with cases that they believe in. Unfortunately, the human factor comes in, and some prosecutors are more concerned about self-aggrandizement and their political career. But I couldn't live in our system if I had such horrible opinion about everybody's corruption and about everybody. There'd be no point in staying alive. If everything is as crooked as everybody thinks it is, why do we even exist?
It's true. I don't think it's as corrupt as, I just think the incentive structure here, if somehow you could measure, I have no idea how you would actually do this, but if you could measure their success on justice, it's a very subjective kind of word, Larry, but if you could measure it on being that, then I think that it would just be very different if you could change how their incentive structure worked.
Well, their incentive is to stay in office. Most people that get elected or not just coming in to serve a brief period of time. That's often their career.
Yep. Well, okay, let's go down that bill that Newsom signed that you're so worked up about. So hopefully you can put a fan up or something and keep yourself from overheating. And I'll read the following that was sent to the senator that you work for in New Mexico. California just signed into law AB 933. What is AB?
I'm assuming it's Assembly Bill.
Oh, Assembly. Okay, very good. Well, you know, I see H bill or SB for House or Senate bill. I've never heard of Assembly bill. All right, so AB, a bill providing protection to sexual assault survivors from weaponized defamation lawsuits. This is a bill that I initially drafted and proposed to the California legislature in the summer of 2022. I am hoping that in this new upcoming session, you will consider authoring the bill for New Mexico. Sexual assault victims, now more than ever, need our help through legislative protections to ensure their voices will not be silenced when speaking out. The Me Too movement encouraged victims to come forward without warning them that doing so will put them at risk of being sued for defamation. How do you incentivize hidden victims to come forward without legal safeguards in place to encourage victims to speak out? You do so by creating a safe space, by fixing defamation laws to have the equivalency of whistleblower protection for sexual abuse victims. You still allow exceptions for defamation lawsuits that meet certain thresholds to go forward to balance discouraging false allegations. So why does this have your hackles all up? What's wrong with this?
Well, before I get into my hackles, the first point is I want to make clear to everybody, this is an example of what I mean when I say that legislators themselves don't stay awake at night burning candles, thinking this stuff up. It's presented to them by various advocates, primarily law enforcement or victim advocates, in this case, victims advocates. This bill will be in a legislative body near you very soon because it's making its way around the country. It sounds wonderful based on what you just read from that email sent to the senator. The devil is always, of course, hidden in the details. Anytime you restrict a person's access to bringing civil lawsuits, the risk is enormous. It's a deterrent against malicious allegations that would be restricted. Right now, there's a deterrent in place because you may get sued. But they're wanting to, well, I mean, we've taken everything else away from the accused. Why not take away the lawsuit as well? So that's where my concerns are.
And so what specifically has you so consternated? We've got the entire text of the chaptered act here, if you'd like to go over it.
Well, sure, I can tell what's got me consternated.
Wow. Constipated?
It's the wording that she claims that has been vetted so well. Section 47.1, subsection A states, quote, a communication made by an individual without malice regarding an incident of sexual assault, harassment, or discrimination is privileged under Section 47. How do we determine that it's without malice? Such a statement could have easily been made with malice. The issue I have also is with the damages. The law states in subsection B, quote, a prevailing defendant in any defamation action brought against the defendant for making communication that is privileged under this section shall be entitled to reasonable attorney's fees and cost for successfully defending themselves, plus treble damages for any harm caused to them by the defamation action against them. In addition, punitive damages are available under subsection 3294, and other relief is permitted by law. This is a significant amount of damages that would dissuade a person from bringing a lawsuit against someone who made malicious or false allegations. That's the problem. That's why I'm consternated.
Could you go back and you said plus treble damages? I mean, I know the word treble from bass and treble. What is treble damages?
That would be three times.
Oh, why don't they say triple?
So, well, I don't know, but I just read it from what was in the article. But three times damages. First of all, how do we gauge the harm that was done to you?
Right.
Okay, how do we figure out triple the harm? And how do we figure out whether it was with malice or not? How do we know you're not delusional? And you may believe that something happened that didn't happen because you've been in treatment and they've convinced you that something happened that didn't happen. This is just junk. Junk. Junk, and it's coming to your state.
And what is then the likelihood, do you think, that this is coming to all of our states?
Oh, I think it's very likely. Based on the reading of the email, this person has made it clear, and then the Forbes article, this is going to all 49 states. It's already been presented in Illinois. It didn't pass on the first vetting, I don't think, but this is definitely coming to a state near you.
The person stated, what I bring to the table for your consideration is, one, a pre-vetted bill, link in the show notes so that I'll provide later, that was signed into law in California this week with a final vote at the California Assembly of, what exactly, Larry? 64-0, which sounds unanimous to me, which shows it is supported by both sides. Are there any Republicans in the California legislature?
Yeah, there's a few.
All right, so it's supported by both sides. And two, a built-in advocacy support system comprised of RAIN, I don't know what R-A-I-N-N is, I don't know what Ultraviolet is, and the National Women's Law Center. I don't know the RAIN and the Ultraviolet, but forgive me on that. And the legal arm of Time's Up, pro bono defense of sexual assault victims from defamation suits, the ERA, the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, ICASA, I-C-A-S-A, see letters to the governor from two advocacy groups, Rain and Ultraviolet, attached. With these assets at your disposal, it would take very little work to make an applicable version for the needs of your state. Do you think it'll make it in your state there in New Mexico?
Not in 2024, but it's something that we have to have a plan in place by 2025.
And why won't it pass in 24 then?
Because it's a short session and the governor would have to place this on the agenda, and she's not likely to with all the other priority items that she has. So I'm predicting 2025. So we've got a year to get prepared for it. But folks, it's coming to your state a lot sooner.
Just like, what's the word? Strategically here, is this something that a NARSAL kind of group would do, is draft boilerplate-ish kind of things to go fight the signs kind of thing? Who would do that sort of thing for anything in our sphere?
At our level at NARSAL, we've discussed having boilerplate legislation. We've never really drafted that type of stuff. When we write in with ideas for legislating, we don't have nearly the takers that they have on their side. When you advocate for victims or survivors, as they call themselves, you have a lot more sympathy than going in saying, I want you to consider this for the sex offenders.
Sure. All right, well, moving along. The author refers to it as the Right to Speak Your Truth Act. It was submitted to the California legislature in the summer of 2022, and that started it all. The writer stated, I have worked with the California ACLU to vet the bill language so I can offer to share with you how the bill language evolved into the current language of the signed California law. For California, the final bill language amended existing defamation laws and created a privilege for sexual assault victims when speaking out. I know what language worked in California, and I can transfer my knowledge in the drafting process of what language passes the vetting standard to help craft the bill into what would work for your state. Does the fact that it was vetted by the ACLU not provide you some level of comfort?
Not very much. I do not consider the ACLU to be the cure-all end-all when it comes to our issues. And when you look at how little they've taken of our cause, I just don't think you can come to that conclusion. They have not taken the leadership in hardly any state. Maybe Michigan would be an exception. Maybe to some level in Louisiana, I think they challenged something in Louisiana that was speech related, but very little. So I would say that their donor base is far more likely to be in opposition to most of our goals. And I just don't think that I can just say, oh, well, the ACLU is for it. That means I'm for it. I think that's an illogical way to look at it.
She also stated, I attached a copy of the Forbes article covering my advocacy with this bill, and my hope is to move my bill into 49 more states. And there's the link, and I have that up on the screen. I felt I was uniquely skilled to draft this legislation, as I am an attorney and law professor, and I've drafted legislation on behalf of the ABA. I guess it's the American Bar Association?
Correct.
Okay. I've drafted legislation on behalf of the ABA as part of my committee work with the organization. And even more directly, I was uniquely positioned as a victim, myself, of a sexual assault following the illicit drugging of my drink. I could capture the firsthand angst of being cautioned by fellow lawyers, friends of mine, not to speak out about what happened to me publicly because it could open me up to a defamation lawsuit. A defamation lawsuit? I was gobsmacked.
Well, I don't know what gobsmacked means, but that was what was what's in the email. But her experience,
flabbergasted.
Her experience is tragic. But that does not necessarily mean that we should. It's like people who say, I've been in foster care. We've got a senator here that spent some time in foster care. I spent a good almost eight years in foster care from the time I was 8 till I was 17 when I exited on my own volition. I don't think that qualifies me to be an expert on foster care. It gives me some insight, but I don't think we should just roll over and say that because she had a tragedy, that makes her an expert on everything related to defamation law and the rights of people who were being accused, some maliciously and falsely. I just don't know how we can come to that conclusion. It is a tragedy, but that doesn't mean that we should say, okay, well, whatever you say, of course, that's what we'll do. That's crazy talk.
She concluded by asking, can you help me secure this protection in your state by authoring the bill? Some fear the death of the Me Too movement because of the high frequency of these weaponized defamation lawsuits. Hence, the timing is ripe to bring this bill forward. Thank you for reading this far. Will she have any trouble finding a sponsor, do you think?
She won't have a bit of trouble finding a sponsor. This bill will be will receive multiple sponsors. It will be difficult to derail. And with all my experience, this one is something that I can't really count on that we can stop. But this is headed to your state. That's her goal, to take it to the other 49 states, as she said. So be on the lookout for it, folks. You heard it first on the Registry Matters podcast.
Hooray. All right, Mr. Doom and Gloom. So we'll move over to this case you wanted to talk about from the New Mexico Supreme Court. It's the state versus Marquez. And the issue is prior bad acts admitted under Rule 404B. I remember 404B, Larry, from us talking about Bill Cosby. That's the only time that I think we've ever talked, or like maybe that's the first time we've ever talked about it. Do you think that's about right?
I do remember that one, but I think we've talked about it other occasions.
All right. Well, doing my own research on that rule, Rule 404B is a legal rule that helps keep things fair in a courtroom. It's like having rules when you play games with your friends, but for grown-up problems. In the big important room called a courtroom, people go to talk about things that went wrong or to solve problems. Just like when you and your friends have rules for playing games, the courtroom has rules to make sure everyone plays fairly and that the truth comes out. Imagine, Larry, you and your friends are playing a game with toys. Now, if you want to show a special toy to your friend, you have to make sure it's related to the game you're playing. You can't just bring out any old toy you like, because that wouldn't be fair. That's a bit, I mean, that's a massively oversimplification of Rule 404B. Do you think that's a decent example?
It's a good example. I would take a little bit of issue about making sure the truth comes out. That's not what courts exist for. But other than that, it's a pretty good example. Rule 404B says that when people are talking about problems in the courtroom, they can't just bring up any old thing from the past. That can be very prejudicial to the accused person. For example, if someone did something wrong, like taking your toy without asking, the judge can only let the grown-ups talk about other things that the person did in the past if it's connected with the current problem. You can't just say, he took my toys, he's a bad kid. They can't just say, hey, the person did bad something once before, so they must be bad now. That wouldn't be fair, and Rule 404B seeks to limit the prosecution's ability to do character assassination. Just because a person makes a mistake and did something in the past, that has nothing necessarily to do with the present.
Hey, man, is this similar to when someone goes to court and they're like, well, I'll get all kinds of character references, and then I've heard the reply, you can do that, but then that opens up the prosecution side to go attack your character?
Well, it does, but it's not the same thing. But yes, if you bring in character evidence, if you introduce your character, you've opened the door, and I would be able to bring in as a prosecutor all your bad character because you put it on the table.
But otherwise, I don't want to say it's not allowed, but it's generally not allowed?
Generally not allowed. There are some exceptions under 404B where evidence can come in, but it's very limited.
All right, and you have the following email from New Mexico. It says, congratulations to Mr. Dodd for obtaining a reversal. Excuse me, I had my mouse covering something. Congratulations to Mr. Dodd for obtaining a reversal of his client's CSPM conviction in State versus Marquez in 2023. Chris's representation of the client is superb. He obtained relief for his 70-plus client, so I guess 70-year-old client, who experienced a trial rife with error. His poor client actually has served his entire sentence waiting for his appeal to conclude. Is he still in prison?
Yes, he actually is, because he wasn't able to find suitable housing even though his sentence has expired. You know, we have that situation similar to Illinois, and you have a mandatory period that we call parole that follows a PFR conviction.
Okay.
He wasn't able to get out of prison because he couldn't find any place to go. So he's sitting there without his Social Security because they don't pay it while you're in prison, and you can't reinstate it until the first full month you're out, and he can't get out to get it reinstated. Now, you have to admit that that's funny.
I'm just going to keep reading because that's not funny. The email states, it's a 404B case where the prosecutors in the case stopped Case stooped to the depths of the most deplorable means to obtain a conviction. Despite a prior court order excluding all 404B evidence, these prosecutors, literally seconds before opening statement, raised the so-called lewd and lascivious exception to persuade this trial judge to actually entertain the issue despite these prosecutors' violation of her own order. Sadly, she later admitted the evidence, while at the same time excluding a defense witness who would have rebutted the testimony. Okay, now Larry, you have to admit that's funny.
Well, I can't admit that that's funny, but it's a sad funny. But all this stuff, this is what you're talking about earlier about prosecutors. I hope they're not all like this. In their mind, they believe that the man is grotesque and needs to be in prison. And they believe that the ends justify the means. I disagree with that. We have a structured process, and you're supposed to play within those rules. The ends do not justify the means, even if it is a creepy individual, but that looks like that they certainly skirted, have not violated some rules in this case. But according to the court, the lewd and lascivious disposition exception has operated as a bona fide exception to the rule barring propensity evidence. The exception authorized admissibility of such evidence on the grounds that evidence of a defendant's past sexual misconduct, similar in nature to the crime of which the defendant was indicted, is illustrative of the lewd and lascivious disposition of the defendant toward the victim.
According to the email, as the NMSC, New Mexico Supreme Court?
Yes.
Okay. As the New Mexico Supreme Court actually noted, the prosecutors ambushed the defense with this issue. The lack of pretrial notice also means that the state failed to offer any authority for its position that the evidence was admissible until the second day of trial, essentially ambushing defendant and the district court. See Marquez at paragraph 34.
Yes, that was a direct quote. And Mr. Dodd successfully argued that the lewd and lascivious exception has actually been abolished in New Mexico. And the court agreed. The court stated nothing in the express language of Rule 11404B mandates the perpetuation of a common law exception to the general prescription of propensity evidence. To the contrary, the lewd and lascivious disposition exception appears to be flatly to contradict the general prescription of propensity evidence found in Rule 11404A and repealed in the first sentence of Rule 11404B. And they're doing a strict textual interpretation of Rule 404B. They're looking at it, and they're saying it ain't in the text, therefore it doesn't exist. This common law exception doesn't exist. This is one of those cases where going by the text comes out nice for us.
So this is good news for sure, though. So how long did this go on? How long did it go on for?
I'm not sure. It's an issue that apparently it just needed the right challenger with the right circumstances, because this common law exception has been around as far back as I could see looking through the case. But the court stated, quote, we agree, whether applied to conduct perpetrated against the complaining witness or someone else, the lewd and lascivious exception authorizes the admissibility of evidence for the express purpose of demonstrating the defendant's propensity to commit the charged offense. And that is plainly prohibited under modern understanding of Rule 11404B, subsection 1.
The court stated, we hold that lewd and lascivious disposition exception to Rule 11-404B1 has been abrogated in New Mexico because the district court relied upon this exception in admitting evidence of other bad acts against the defendant, and the error was not harmless. We vacate defendant's convictions and remand the matter to the district court. Should the state elect to retry defendant on these charges, the evidence at issue may not be admitted against him unless the district court first determines that it is admissible under the 2022 amendment of Rule 11-404B for a non-propensity purpose and otherwise meets the requirements of Rule 11-403. Could you dumb that down for me, please?
Well, it means that they're going to have to fit within the exceptions of 404B, and there are things where it can come in, but it's not for establishing your bad character. It's something unique. The biggest exception is something unique that only you would do. And it's your trademark. So it would show method, mode of operation, what do you call it, modus operandi. It shows the lack of mistake. Something unique, a person making obscene telephone calls, for example, if they have a propensity to call high school gymnasiums and they have a propensity to ask for only the young male athletes at the high school gymnasium. If that school starts getting a whole bunch of obscene telephone calls and the tracing reveals that the calls originated from your house, that can be admitted to show that you likely were the culprit. If you have five housemates, you say, well, I didn't make the calls. There's four other people living here. Well, they showed that this is exactly the type of call that you made. But it's not to show that you're a bad person. It's to show something unique and a trademark of how you operate. And so 404B can be used to get in evidence, but it's not for the purpose of just showing that you're a creep.
I see. And so just to be clear, this is good news, at least for this individual. It's good news, right?
It is good news for sure.
And, did they let him out?
Not yet.
Why?
It has to come down. The Supreme Court has issued a decision. The mandate has to come back down through the system. The state has to decide if it's going to seek a new trial. They'll have to decide if they're going to give him bond to be released pending new trial. There's a whole lot of machinations that have to take place. But no, he's not out, and he's not likely to be out anytime soon.
Seriously. And how long, I don't remember, how long has he been locked up so far?
I'm not even sure if I spotted that in the case, but it's been a long time.
Are you like 5 years long time or 30 years long time?
Not 30 years, but many, many years he's been locked up. So,
and in the meantime, he could be set free and he could have one of those things like the riot that happened in your prison system there and whatever it was where 20 people died or whatever that was.
33 to be precise, and that was in...
Oh, sorry, 33. I was trying to overestimate, and it's 33. Good
February of 1980. But there was a quote from the email that someone says that I've co-counseled cases with Chris Dodd at trial and personally know just how truly brilliant he is as a trial litigator, but his appellate skills now simply speak for themselves. It's truly true travesty of justice that this elderly client has paid a dear price that so many others, so many others' despicable thirst for conviction at all costs. Chris has truly given Mr. Marquez the hope that he has been deprived of for so many years. And I haven't really thought through the possible ramifications, but it could have ramifications beyond him, depending on if this propensity, if this particular exception has been used to convict others. If I'm sitting in prison and I find out about this case and something like this came in my case, you better believe I'm going to be citing this case and trying to get another bite at the apple.
Of course. Do you have anything else that you want to cover this episode?
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Yeah, what about that grand jury article from that liberal left-leaning rag, The Nation?
Is it really a liberal lefty rag?
I've had people tell me that. I'm not sure.
I don't know really anything about them. I remember seeing the title on the way. All right. The title of this is, It's Time to Abolish Grand Juries Once and for All. Do you agree?
I'm very close to agreeing with that. Yes, I do. The article states, whether they're targeting Donald Trump or Cop City protesters, grand juries are irredeemable and unaccountable tool for the state prosecutorial power. And I observed that in my 3-month term, and I'm leaning towards agreeing.
Is this a reversal? Would you have thought that they were a valuable tool prior to your term there, so to speak?
Oh, I absolutely would have thought it. I dreamed that the citizens that go sit on these juries I dreamed that they were told what a crucial role that they play. And it is. It's actually in the grand jury manual. They had these binders that had all the rules that we had to operate within. And they had a binder that told you what the purpose was. And it said that you are the fine line between the uncontrolled, unchecked power of the state. But I don't think a single juror read that. And I would point that out to them. I would say on page 11 of our grand jury manual, it tells us that we are critical to the process of acting as a check and balance on the state's power. And those people looked at me like I beamed in from Saturn. It's like,
Larry, I sat on jury. So, I mean, obviously that's after grand jury. And I was that person that was like, we are going to lock a person up if we find them guilty. And we have to take this seriously and not just, I don't know, whatever, just sign off on it saying that they're guilty, whatever the prosecutor wants. We have to like contemplate this because this person is depending on us on both sides. The DA and the defense is depending on us to weigh the evidence.
So, well, I was sorely disappointed.
All right. Well, then tell me what the purpose of a grand jury is, or is the purpose of grand jury. Brenda, which way is the right way to do that grammatically? All right. Anyway, what is the purpose?
Well, a grand jury, according to the article, I agree, a grand jury is a legal proceeding intended to determine whether there is the minimum amount of evidence necessary to charge someone with a crime and then issue formal charges called indictments, which we did. We rubber stamped everyone that the state brought to us. In the federal system, in 23 states, grand jury indictments are required in at least some felony cases. And 25 states make grand jury indictments optional. And two states, Connecticut and Pennsylvania, have abolished indicting grand juries altogether, but retain provisions for investigative grand juries.
How then does the process work in real life?
Well, the grand jury process is blunt and straightforward. A prosecutor presents evidence and witnesses to the grand juries and request they approve an indictment. So picture pre-COVID, they sat at a big round oblong table. In my COVID experience, we sat in classroom setup. We had desks and tables. So okay. Each person was sitting. There's no judge. There's no defense attorney in the courtroom. There's the prosecutor standing at the lectern. There's a witness place, witness stand. And there's all the electronic gadgetry you need to show videos and play audios and all that stuff. And the prosecutor presents the witnesses. There's the proceedings are secret, and the prosecutor decides what information is presented. And usually the law enforcement agents who investigate a case, they're the only ones called to the grand jury. But other civilian witnesses can be compelled to appear and testify as well. But we never compelled anybody. They told us, we have in our orientation, you've got all this power to compel witnesses. And if we would ask about a witness, well, did anybody see this? They would go, huh? Or any other witnesses? What do you mean any witness? We just had the officer testify. We didn't get anywhere. If we even dared ask a question, we were kind of dismissed. And it was kind of like the way they do, what is it called, group dynamics. They shame you into thinking that you're the oddball for asking such silly questions. And so the prosecutor calls the detective that investigated the case, and then they open it for questions if the jurors have any questions. And that's the only shot that you have at it if you ask a question. And the officers are well-trained. They've done these 1,000 times before, and they know how to answer and deflect most questions. And they tell you what you want to hear. And at the end of it, you say, well, it's a very low threshold. We'll just indict them, and the defense attorney and the real court above can straighten it out later. That's what we did.
All right. Well, then it seems that in theory, grand juries give a body of disinterested citizens who review cases the power to ensure there is sufficient evidence before the government can charge someone with a crime. That's why the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees you the right to have your case presented to a grand jury alongside your right to remain silent and your right to due process. So what's the reality with that one there?
My experience is that grand juries seldom, if ever, serve as a check on the state prosecutorial power. Instead, they serve primarily to conceal and legitimize that power and get out of there as quick as possible. Do you think it's kind of ironic that our primary jury day was on Friday? So we go in on Friday morning at 8 o'clock, and we look at this huge docket that's up on the wall. The first thing they tell us to do is to make sure we don't know any of the witnesses, be the target, as they're called, because they're not a defendant yet. Do we know any of the targets, or do we know any of the witnesses that are going to be presenting or witnesses that are called? If so, we need to disclose that. Well, so you see this huge list, because all these names of people, so there's like 16, 18, 20 cases on the list, and they say, well, you know, we've got a pretty heavy docket today, but we're going to try to get you ahead of early, get you out early. Well, what do you think would happen if you started being more diligent? Do you think you would get out early, or do you think you would get out late?
You would certainly get out later.
That's correct. And we stayed late one time, and we learned our lesson about that, because we stayed to like we stayed to like 6:30 early on in the term, and they made it clear to us there were people coming from security from the court. They were knocking on the grand jury room's door. They were making it known to us that we were not supposed to be staying that late. And the prosecutor told us, well, you know, some of these deliberations went extremely long. And, you know, we've got all these cases to go through, but you just roll them over. But that's not what they do. They keep you there until you get through the whole docket. Well, what do you think you're going to do if you're there on a Friday and you want to go home and you have this huge docket? Are you going to rubber stamp everything, or are you going to be diligent?
Why don't you rubber stamp saying no? Does it have to be rubber stamp saying yes?
Well, because you've got good citizens on there that believe the cops have got the right person, that they would that they would do no wrong. They see these prosecutors at their Sunday school class, and they know them. They've known them since they were little kids, and they just say, we've got to do it.
Hey, you want to hear something funny, Larry? Do you know how many grand juries were left in the world as of 2023?
How many?
Liberia. Well, there are two countries. Liberia, this is not what I would consider the mecca of judicial integrity, I suppose. And then the United States. So we are the only ones, these two countries, that maintain the grand jury system. Why would that be?
I have no idea, because in theory, it could be a fantastic tool, but it isn't. So, as I said earlier, prosecutors exercise almost absolute control of the grand jury process. And there's no constraints on what type of evidence the prosecutor can present. Now, that's not the reality. If you've got a rebel on the jury, you can say, I want to take this to the presiding judge. But if you do that, if you stop that machine and you tell the prosecutor, I object, I want to take this to the presiding judge, since there's really no judicial oversight. You do that, I suspect that your term is going to end. What do you think?
Not well.
So.
So what happens in the rare instances of a no bill by a grand jury?
Well, you would think that that would end the case, but it doesn't.
Oh, there's still more.
Oh, yeah. Your right against double jeopardy does not apply because you haven't been subjected to an adversarial process. Remember, this is not adversarial. So if a particular grand jury refuses to issue an indictment, nothing stops a highly motivated prosecutor from presenting the case again and again with evidence to a subsequent grand jury for a second or third bite at the apple. But more importantly, unlike trial juries, grand jury's decision does not need to be unanimous. So a lone holdout has no impact. It only took 8 in my case in our system here. So grand
juries. Is it just majority, supermajority, what?
It was just 8. They didn't tell us how they got to that number, but that was what was required for an indictment. So if you
How many people are on the panel?
12.
Okay. All right.
But they didn't
That's
tell
fine.
Us.
I mean, no, okay.
So grand jurors are highly susceptible to groupthink because their work is so insulated from the outside. And they meet regularly. They can make case for 3 months, and they can be longer terms. And we had twice a week sessions for some of those weeks because they were backlogged. And we got to know each other. And we knew from that time together, I knew that I was fighting a futile battle.
Right. Did you end up like having lunch with any of these folks?
Very infrequently, but yes, once or twice. But I didn't want to be around most of them because they were nuts.
Well, so if that's the case, though, in all of your big noodleage that you have going on, what would be the alternative to this? What could be an alternate system that would be better?
Well, the system, the only other alternative would be is a probable cause hearing, meaning that you would have a judicial officer that's trained in the law, and you'd have the prosecutor come into a courtroom with an adversarial process where they have to put on a little mini trial. And those already exist, but the problem with that is the attorneys waive the probable cause hearing. Here's what the attorney tells you. So you go and you pay your attorney $30,000 to take your case. So what they would do in a case like that where you would be entitled to a probable cause hearing, let's just pick state of Georgia for an example. So you're going to go before a probable cause hearing, and I think they conduct those in what they call before magistrate judges. So you're going to go before a magistrate judge. So the attorney's got your $30,000. It's already half spent by the time you get to the probable cause hearing. So the attorney tells you, well, they're going to find probable cause. We just might as well waive this and start putting our engine and getting ready for trial. That is about the most ridiculous strategy I've ever heard of, but that's what the attorneys tell you. Now, if you're already working with the prosecution, you've already decided that the evidence is overwhelming, and you're already negotiating a plea, that would be a situation where you would waive the probable cause hearing, because if I'm the prosecutor, you put me through, if I have to get ready for a probable cause hearing, and we're working on what I think is going to be a good plea for your client, and I'm going to stick my neck out to give your client a good offer, don't make me do a hearing. If you make me do a hearing, I'm going to take that offer off the table. But a lot of attorneys will tell you to waive it anyway because, frankly, they don't want to get ready for the hearing. Well, you need to get ready for that hearing because if there's no fruitful negotiations taking place, you need to figure out how strong the case is going to be, how credible the witnesses are going to come across. They may call somebody other than a law enforcement officer who's a trained professional witness. You want to see if that witness is going to hold up under cross. You can't do all that by waiving it. So I'm a big believer in not waiving hearings, but that's what they're going to do. So that's not an answer either, but that's the only one I've come up with.
I see. Okay. I got nothing else to talk about on that. I have one little added segment if you're ready to go over there.
Let's do it. What are we doing?
Okay. Well, someone posted on the Discord server just a little while ago about... are you familiar with who Bubba the Love Sponge is?
Can't say it rings a bell.
He's a shock jock. I guess you could say that he's something similar to Howard Stern. I'm sure you've heard of Howard Stern.
Yes, that's my brother.
Okay. I don't think so. But okay, so... anyway, I'm almost inclined to just start playing the video. These two knuckleheads are going to the doors of people that live near Tampa, Florida, and they are posting signs in their yards, Larry. So is it okay if I start playing this and just tell me where you'd be okay with me stopping, and we'll see how that goes?
So you're telling me to cut in at any time?
Yeah, just tell me and I'll try to press pause as quickly as I can.
All right.
John, come on out, bud. We need to talk to you for a minute, John.
Mommy, I love your shirt. Thank
you. Hello, John.
Hey, John, for this holiday season, we know that you were registered sexual battery of a child under 12 years old in 1998. So we know we don't want people participating in Halloween this year, so we're doing a little community outreach. We're going to be putting a sign out in your yard saying,
under Florida section 775.21, we have the right to post a sign publicly. So to inform neighbors that you're a registered sexual predator.
Okay, well, they posted something up there on the screen. They have a little shot of, they're saying that they have a Florida statute, 775-21.
Yes.
Did you look that up?
I did look that up, and I don't see anything in the statute that requires signs or even authorizes signs. I don't see anything in there.
To what degree of sketchy ground are these guys on?
Very sketchy, because there's a case from Butts County, Georgia, called McClendon versus Long, and that's a precedent from the 11th Circuit, which includes Florida, and you can't force people to speak in this manner.
It just, the sign being present is equivalent to being forced to speak?
Well, this is a little bit more nuanced, but yes, in McClendon versus Long, that was being required by the sheriff of Butts County, Georgia, and it's a presidential decision. But in this case, since it's not being required by law enforcement, it presents a unique difference. If I had been the guy, I'd have told him to FYP. But I'd have told him, if you don't get off my property, you're going to soon wish that you had. But that's just what I would have done.
That sounds threatening, Larry.
Well, that's exactly what, when someone comes on my property and tells me they're going to post a sign and there's no authority for it, what else would you tell them? Well, go ahead and put all the signs you want to.
That's what these individuals, they at least acquiesced. They just relented and let it happen. I mean, I'm assuming that these two guys were completely blindsided by this and they had no preconceived thought of how they would respond to it.
Well, again, I don't see any legal authority for it. It seems like I would call this vigilante activity, but the 11th Circuit is a binding case, and it includes Alabama, Florida, and Georgia. And it's one of the 13 appellate courts in the United States. And it's certainly very problematic for this. I'm shocked that it's being done.
I'm not shocked. It is Florida. Oh, shit. I pressed the wrong button. Predator. Oh, my God.
You're also to make sure that you have your lights down and not have any interaction with children for Halloween.
It said that sexual battery with a 12-year-old in 1990.
I don't even really want to play the parts like this where they're actually like calling the guy out. I don't want to really dox the guy. I don't have any interest. He just like is cowering behind the door. He's like petrified. I'm sure people have come knocked on his door before. He doesn't live the most, serene life, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, I saw the door. He barely had it open, which was good. But he should have opened it enough to put the barrel of his shotgun out.
Well, he's a convicted felon, Larry. He probably doesn't have one. But I mean, why? I would like if I saw these knuckleheads coming up to the door, I am not answering the door.
Well, I'm as adamant about the door as you are about a telephone. You will not get me to ever answer a door.
And I might give my dog some Alka-Seltzer so their faces are foaming, and then I open up the door and I have two foaming at the mouth dogs coming at them.
I can't imagine why people are terrified to answer a little ringing device, but they'll answer the door where they can get blown away. But maybe
I'm not answering the door either.
Yeah, I don't answer doors. Haven't answered them in 20 years.
And so then they go to this other guy's house, Larry. They go, there's another one. This guy looks like he has very limited English abilities.
Thank you.
They say thank you as they walk away.
This is John Mark.
Oh my God, I don't want to do that one either. Okay.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, my name's Alex Stein. I'm here. We're doing community outreach with the Bubba Army. We saw you had the Lewd and Lavicious Act in 1998. Yeah, you failed to register. Well, we don't.
And he also had a failure to register in Florida. So I'm like, that probably escalates you up to be an SVP just by failing to register in Florida.
I don't think it does that, but these people are doing something that's very problematic for sure.
To what is it? Is it illegal problematic?
Well, I don't think there's a law per se against it, but I would think there's some laws that would cover it, like encroachment on private property, trespassing. You're doing something that you're not authorized to do.
Is there anything against them driving in the truck? And I know, Larry, and I completely know that you're just like speculating. I get that. But is there anything driving around in the truck with the blinky, blinky lights all over it? They're advertising. They're drawing a crap ton of attention to themselves that then gets focused on you. And they're posting these guys' information on this video. Is that doxing? Is that illegal?
I don't know if that is per se, but there are all these admonishments about this PFR registry. It's not supposed to be used to harass. And I don't know if there's any statutory provision in Florida about misusing the PFR list, but you always, when you accept the terms of use, when you go look on the registry, it always says, I will not use this to harass.
They are definitely doing that with it though, Larry. All right. So I'm going to cut the video there because I don't really want to go through a whole lot more. I don't remember there being anything completely off the rails on that, the rest of it. They're all up in your face and they're recording it. They got a camera up there. They're harassing this guy because he has limited English skills as well. But, can we get a little background though? You talked about the case McClendon versus Lyle. What was that about?
Oh, you expect me to remember a case from 4 years ago?
That was the case. I do. That's why I gave you some cheater notes.
Oh, that was the case where it was launched in Georgia against two counties, Butts and Spalding County. And both of those sheriffs were telling people to place signs, and they were actually placing the signs and threatening them with prosecution if they removed the signs, say no candy handed out here for Halloween. It didn't really say necessarily that the person was PFR, but it says by orders of the sheriff. This sign is erected on orders of the sheriff, and no Halloween, no candy. There was an injunction sought, which was granted to stop them from doing it in 2019. And then the case went to trial, We lost at trial, and then on appeal, it was turned around and victory. And now the case is being used as precedential authority. There's a case been launched or about to be launched in Missouri challenging their statute that has that requirement in the statute where Georgia didn't have it. So that's a case that's going to be long-lasting in its impact because everyone's going to be citing to it now. And it was okay. The National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws that sponsored that action. We don't get any credit from anybody, not much credit from the attorney that handled it, but that attorney was reached out to by us. We seeded the financial well with money because he wasn't willing to do it without compensation. And we kept the compensation flowing because he had to brief it twice because of bogus arguments that they put up on appeal. And we pursued that case relentlessly to the very end with a victory. And now others will use it and pretend like that they have thought of something that we didn't think of. They didn't think of it. We thought of it. And in fact, I was told that I was going after something I shouldn't waste my time with because there was bigger fish to fry. And why are you going after this? Because it's not going to bring down the registry. But now some of the people that said that, they're launching the case now in Missouri.
I don't detect any sort of resentment or animosity there. So the 11th Circuit comprises what states again?
Georgia, Florida, and Alabama.
And there are how many circuits? Did you say 12?
There's actually 11 complete circuits. There's no 12th, but then there's some special courts. There's a D.C. circuit, which is the 12th, and then there's some special, like, courts of appeal that are secret. I forget what it's called, but anyway, there's certainly 12, not counting the specialty circuit.
All right. And so these people in this video, they're not law enforcement, I don't believe. Could they have been, like, deputized or honorary sheriffs or something like that to have the authority to do it?
They could have been, but they should have stated that we've been deputized special deputies for Hillsborough County, and we're making this visit on behalf of the Sheriff's Department.
And we already covered the statute part. I looked up and read through whatever statute they're citing, and I didn't find anything that said anything about signs or notifications or anything like that. Somebody in chat says that they post a sign on your property that says no trespassing. What kind of weight would that carry if you posted a sign that says no trespassing on your property?
Well, you'd have to figure out how to enforce that. Is it a criminal or is it a civil sanction? Getting the cops to come out and enforce a no trespassing against somebody like that would be very unlikely, in my opinion. You call the police and say, well, I'm on the PFR list and I got somebody out here. I just don't think that they're going to rush to your house to do that. So then do you seek a civil remedy? And if so, who do you file the lawsuit against? Do you know who they are? What are your damages? It's kind of like we talked about in the earlier episode. How would you quantify your damages?
Yeah, other than being doxxed and harassed and pointed out, I mean, most of the people on the list are trying to keep their head down and not draw attention to themselves, and that's what these guys are doing.
Well, they would say you're already out by virtue of being on the registry. You would have a tough time trying to prove any damages.
True. Gotcha. All right. I don't have anything else. Do you have anything else?
Nope. Well, we have a great episode coming next week, don't we?
I believe so. We're going to have a special guest joining us for, I think it's the third time. It could even be the fourth time. Do we get any snail mail subscribers?
We did not. But that episode next week, we're going to be talking about entrapment. And I know people love entrapment episodes.
They do. Well, to get out of here, we did get a new patron named Jamie, and I thank Jamie very much. And I want to try and start doing this on a regular basis. But so we have a collection of people that have, I've titled them, Larry, in honor of the mafia. These are the Dons of Donation. Because, you know, if you're part of the mafia, you're a Don.
Okay.
And so we have Justin, Mike, Brian, another Brian, VP, LB, Uncle Gerald, and Hank. And these are the folks that deserve extra special recognition for their support of the show. And I thank you guys so very much.
Well,
and I don't have anything else, man. Do you have anything else?
I have a thanks to the people that are offering assistance on the transcript. I'm getting an amazing amount of desire to help with that. We appreciate it. I went through the transcript that was submitted last week, and it's fairly clean. And I'm going to have my proofreader look at it and see how clean it is. And we may be getting back to that person to see how we can perfect that. But we've had several offers. We got a good transcript last week. So thank you. Thank you, everyone. Maybe we can keep the service running.
Very good. Go over and find all the show notes at registrymatters.co, and I will leave it at that. You can find Patreon links and phone numbers and email addresses from there. And without anything else, I bid you a fine evening, and everyone in chat, thank you for coming and hanging out. And I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.